What I'm going to do today is I'm going to cover all the authors in the book from Unit 1 to Unit 12. So I'm going to try to devote 4 or 5 minutes to talking about each of the authors, and I'm going to incrementally give you information about each of the authors regarding the previous ones. So possible questions that could be a part of exam material, we're going to see them only in an imaginary way. As I told you before, I haven't brought exams to this classroom for today. That's not the purpose of this class. I'm just going to go over a general review. And I'm going to, and I don't have access to the exam, so I don't know exactly what they're going to ask you. I have absolutely no idea. Those exams, anyway, Professor Givet is a thorough planner. She's probably written those exams in August, and they're already sealed and prepared. They've been done for months by now. So our first stop, of course, let me see if I can write here. Let me see if this works. Okay. Where is my board here? The first author that we're going to cover is Captain John Smith. Okay, so in the case of Captain John Smith, we're going to we start the course learning about the first explorers that arrive to America. So I think that a good starting point would be to separate or to segregate Captain John Smith's intention and mission with the rest of the authors that we're going to read. The rest are either settlers or they're dwellers of inhabitants of America, afterwards to be called the United States. In this case, the Captain John Smith is purely an explorer of the New World. He is a very experimented sailor and explorer, a military man, and his military background it serves as a backdrop to his perception of the New World. He is extremely interested in the Native Americans. There is a immediate interest in the Native Americans, but from a descriptive point of view, taking into consideration his trade, he's going to be interested in the way that Native Americans organize, the way they create their cities, the way they defend their cities, the way they arm themselves, the way they defend themselves, military tactics, and so on. So John Smith has many things that make him a unique person and a special firsthand witness of this new unexplored world. And one of the things that he's going to provide is his extreme ability in map making. As an experimented map maker, he's going to produce some of the most accurate maps that America will have for several centuries. So his work is by no means small in impact. His work has a very deep and long-lasting impact. First, from the visual point of view of map making, and afterwards, when he returns as a teller, a storyteller of the account of the time that he spends in Virginia, New England, and the Summer Isles, as he himself calls it. We're going to have a problem with Captain John Smith's way of representing the New World, because there is an obvious boastfulness in his a boastful attitude in his account, and this subtracts from it. It puts into question the reliability of his account, the reliability of everything that he decides to tell about his time in America. The second problem that we have is that we know that the account shifts over time, a shifting narrative over time, and it includes more and more details that were previously unrevealed, a shifting story, and therefore it plays against the reliability of his story. In particular, we can refer to the episode with Pocahontas and how he is apparently saved from death from this person that is a real person, but it remains in doubt. It remains questionable that Captain John Smith ever did get to meet Pocahontas, and that he was actually saved by her or not. So the events that take place in his life, in his brief period of time in the New World, let's see, go to the third, fourth slide. The events that take place in the New World are always put into doubt because of how there seems to be an agenda to elevate his importance within the story, but at the same time, the impact of his story is incredible, and he manages almost single-handedly to attract people to America by the thousands, because there was this immediate feel that across the Atlantic Ocean there was a land of opportunity, there was a land of wealth, there was a land of riches to be conquered and to be taken, and while some people will travel to America, and we'll see that over the following units, in search of religious freedom, others are going to travel to America in search of wealth, in search of a better opportunity, and that was the mainstream reason that attracted so many thousands to America over the first decades of settling. We're talking about, in this case, the framework that we're talking about is the early 16th century. Sorry, 17th century, not the 16th century, the 17th century. Things that we pointed out in the studying the unit that I would like to bring up ideas would be I already talked about how important his role as a map maker was, and how the image of America that's portrayed is portrayed as a land of opportunity, and others are going to pick up on the idea that it is also going to be the land of religious freedom, and that's going to trigger something that he already starts to manifest, Captain John Smith, the manifest destiny. And we're going to talk about the manifest destiny a little later. Okay. John Smith arrives at Jamestown in 1607. He is governor of Virginia in 1608 and 1608 to 1609. He has an accidented time in America. And when upon returning, he is never allowed to return to Virginia because, among other things, he had been arrested during his time there. So there are many situations regarding the stay of Captain John Smith in America that remain unknown. Or at least not as clear and subject to speculation. In this course, we're going to try not to speculate. So we're going to leave it as is. His reliability is questionable, and the importance of his writings were that they were extremely promotional, and that there was a significant interest in depicting very accurately, but from the point of view of what he found of interest, his military point of view, what he saw in the New World. The first of his relevant works is considered the first English work written in America, a true relation of such occurrences and accidents of note as has happened in Virginia. Was written in 1608 and published in London in the same year. So as you can see, things are very fast at the beginning, but afterwards he rewrites his story several times, adding different glimpses to his early 17th century trips. In the 1620s, he writes two different versions of the original work. The first one called General History of Virginia, New England, and the Summer Isles. And the third one sounds even more as a fictional tale, The True Travels, Adventures, and Observations of Captain John Smith in Europe, Asia, Africa, and America, which compile partially his time in America, besides other trips that were noteworthy in his life and mostly previous to his time in America. The map of Virginia is the one that you can see in the image, and the map of New England is the one that you can see in the image. As I said, remarkably accurate, very, very accurate. This map precedes the arrival of the pilgrims to Plymouth in 4 years, but this map at the same time works as a magnet and works as a sort of layout of the promised land to the future generations and to everybody that was planning on going to America. The next author that we're going to cover is William Bradford. William Bradford is a religious figure that we have to connect through a different perspective that we use for Captain John Smith. In the case of Captain John Smith, we talked about an explorer and a map maker. In the case of William Bradford, we're going to talk about a providentialist. Let me see, there's a question there. The leader of the Puritan Pilgrim Fathers. Yes, please. I was just trying to write because I find it a bit hard to write and think of my sentences ahead of time, even if it's only a name. In the case of William Bradford, we're going to talk about a providentialist governor and leader. His importance is prime because he belongs to what is considered the foundational the cultural foundation of the United States of America. Nowadays, Americans study their history starting with the Pilgrims. So even though the times of William Bradford take place 1 century and a half before becoming an independent nation, from a cultural point of view and due to the United States being a very religious country in essence, the trip of the persecuted pilgrims aboard the Mayflower, as Jose is so correctly stating, is considered the starting point of the American people. So even though this is culturally incredibly questionable, this is a questionable matter, no matter how you phrase it, because this is happening 1 century and a half before there's even an American nation. The foundation of the American people, according to the most widespread belief of the Americans, takes place in this moment. And what we could say that is absolutely true is that this is a point where America and the motherland, England, start to diverge significantly. There is a religious segregation. Religious segregation in terms of back in the British Isles, in Britain, there was a persecution for being for belonging to a different church than the Church of England. But in America, there's going to be religious freedom. So this freedom to be religious or not be religious is used as a strong magnet for a Calvinist, and among Calvinists for the Puritans to find their safe haven. And this safe haven is going to literally put them on a religious mission. And the initial word that I use to describe William Bradford, providentialist, or the other word that we use, a Jeremiad, the Jeremiad tone of their communication, that this continuous lament of their situation with God, and trying to be worthy of the covenant with God, and trying to maintain the covenant or this pact, this divine pact, where they understand that they're going to be the chosen people, and America is going to be the chosen land. So the idea that we floated before of manifest destiny, which is an absolutely European concept that basically says that whatever military or geographic expansion a European nation decides to pursue is absolutely legitimate, and they have to not they don't have to take into consideration the rights or the traditions of other people that were living in that land before them. What we're going to see is going to be an ever increasing pressure over the Native Americans, and that pressure is going to push the Native Americans that were on the east board of America farther and farther to the center of the country until they are exterminated or they're massively reduced. And the same thing is going to happen with all of the Native American tribes that they find on their way towards the West. Because one of the things that we see in America from a very early stage is once the scramble for the West starts, it never stops. The 7-year war that precedes the American War of Independence only sparks an even higher interest in expanding westward and in extending the sentiment of the manifest destiny that promises riches and lands and opportunity for everybody that moves towards the West. That is going to be another one of the American myths. A part of this myth are the pilgrims and how they are considered the saints in this story, that land in America to purge the lack of faith of other Americans that when they're aboard the Mayflower, they are known as the others. And we know that vocabulary such as this, vocabulary is not neutral. Vocabulary is normally loaded with meaning. And in this case, whenever you call someone an other, you're sort of dehumanizing this group of people by saying that only a very limited group of pilgrims are going to have access to heaven. Talks about a type of religion which was typical of the religions of the 17th century, where there is no free will. There is an explicit predestination. God already has his plan designed, and it is up to me to be worthy. Men have to be worthy of salvation. And that is the only worry that men on earth have to have. They have to have an everlasting fear for not following the covenant, for not being worthy of salvation, and therefore falling as the others, the non-religious Europeans and the Native Americans that are also part of this, to hell. And in the case of the Puritans, is going to be very, very clear, Calvinism in general, that this is going to be a fundamentalist type of religion where not everyone is destined to salvation. Some are destined to salvation while others are destined to not being able to access heaven because they don't follow the same type of Reformed church, or they're not religious at all, which seem to be the pre-requirements for this time. So we've talked about William Bradford, the person. What about William Bradford, the writer? Let's go back to where we were and talk about William Bradford's works. In the case of William Bradford's works, there are basically two items that made his time in America especially relevant. The two parts of Plymouth Plantation, the two volumes. In the first volume, there are 12 chapters that describe the events of the Scooby Group before going to America and the voyage and colony's beginnings. This talks about the religious persecution and how it puts them on a mission to reach salvation. And the second volume is in the form of annals of the life in America. It spans from 1620, the arrival, to 1646. And what we see is a gradual disappointment of the author, and that's a very important key word, disappointment of the author towards the loss of unity in a once cohesive community. Those are the works that we read about in the in the course. And basically we read one chapter from book one and one chapter from book two of this work of Plymouth Plantation. Okay, so let's continue and suddenly change the genre from a purely Jeremiad style type of writing to poetry, and this is going to be our first incursion in poetry. Let me first move to Anne Bradstreet's opening slide. Anne Bradstreet it still belongs to families that emigrate to America. So the first three authors of our overview are going to be people that live in America, but are not born in America, and I think this is a significant a thing to take into consideration. Anne Bradstreet, first poet in America, first female poet in America. Talking about glass ceilings, this can be probably the first glass ceiling shatter in American history. First female poet in America. Her works seem to have been published without her knowledge, or at least without her full approval, and by a brother-in-law. So she feels addressed at prefacing them, extending them, reworking them, and republishing something that would only happen, unfortunately, after the author's death. From the point of view of how this impacted your work in the PEC, one of the things that you have to take into consideration, and I think that this flew over the head of many of you, was the importance of self-deprecation, of intentionally downtoning the importance or removing the importance of her own work. Was that because she was extremely humble and extremely religious? No, it was. It's a defense mechanism, and this defense mechanism is to avoid being excessively criticized by the rest of the community, by other Puritans, because she understood. She understood what it was to be a good Puritan. So she knew that the role of women was very limited, and she had to stand out as a good mother, a good wife, and a good Puritan. So these ideas are pervading, and the reason why she would self-deprecate her work in, for example, the preface poem of her work would be as a way of protecting her triple role as a Puritan woman. She also understood in all of the poems there always seems to be an inner struggle, but she ultimately accepts. The almightiness of God. So we could say that Anne Bradstreet walks a tightrope of the thin line that separates sounding as if she were not a good Puritan with questioning some of the things that a good Puritan should never question themselves about. But always, ultimately, within the same poem, going through that journey back to becoming a good Puritan. So what she does is that she demonstrates her humanity, ultimately. She is able of stripping her ideas, expressing her doubts, expressing her inner feelings, and at the same time using that as a path to return to the expectations of Puritanism. So Anne Bradstreet fulfills an extremely difficult role of writing poetry in a community where poetry was not seen as something that was beneficial for the Puritans, and of course something that was beyond the duties or the preoccupations of a good Puritan mother and wife. And she managed to do that without losing any sort of prestige regarding herself or her family. She had to defend herself for writing poetry because she was a Puritan or because she was a Puritan mother. It's like, if she was a man, she would already have to defend herself. But being a Puritan woman just made things worse, to say it in a certain manner. It made her have to use this defense mechanism even more. As Patricia says, both. It's the Puritans are not expected to write unless there is a good reason, and we're going to see those good reasons in the next. In the next author that we cover, and the good reasons have to be following Puritan norm, and Puritan norm is not poetry. It's not metaphors. It's not rhyming and looking for nice structures. What Puritans the way that Puritans are supposed to express themselves is through this work that we referred to before when we were talking about women could write in a private atmosphere. They could write in a private atmosphere of friends and family. The problem was that these poems had gone beyond the atmosphere of friends and family, and even so. What was tolerable was to write, but the contents of the writing should never go beyond the tenets of Puritanism. And Anne Bradstreet was extremely skilled in treading those waters in a very safe way, and not walking outside of the narrow space that she had to express her ideas in a reasonable manner according to the standards of her community. Mary Rowlandson was another person to write, and the stories that Puritans were supposed to read about, express, and share were the Jeremiads. The Jeremiads are ultimately stories that talk about the loss of faith of God in its community and among the Puritans, and how there was an attempt to restore the covenant. Okay, this covenant is this pact with God. Restore the covenant. And lament about the lack of faith. So Puritans had this terrible way of seeing themselves as tremendous underachievers in terms of religious compliance. So since they were always seeing their faults magnified and their and the good things that they were doing as marginal or not relevant enough, they always felt as if they were in debt with their religious duties, and they were always full of this of what is called this fear of God. And while that was the dominant chain of thought, Puritans as a community or as a group were very successful. Things started to change when at the end of the 17th century, and the 18th century is met with a collective loss of faith. Before this collective loss of faith happens, we have to talk about Mary Rowlandson and how her work is the most important representation. Captivity. I'm so bad at talking and writing different things at the same time. I don't know if that's normal. I hope it is. Mary Rowlandson is a good example of captivity narrative. Her work is a good example of captivity narrative. And this is truly the first American genre, a genre that is full of emotion, excitement, and thrill. Just to put it in a different way, captivity narratives were the first thrillers that talked about how difficult it was to be out in the rough with the Native Americans that were full of lust willing to commit violent and vicious acts against the local community that was portrayed as patient, peaceful, and bearing the terrible suffering inflicted by the Native Americans. So these captivity narratives are normally pieces of information that arrived to other readers as if they were exciting fiction. So they're treated from the same point of view as, for example, I don't know, Treasure Island could be treated, or Robinson Crusoe. From the point of view of Mary Rowlandson, she follows she has a series of features about her that make her story all the better. First of all, she's a good Puritan. She's she follows Puritan principles from beginning to end. Does that mean that her character throughout the story, as she writes her autobiography or this episode of autobiography, is going to be a flat character? No, we're going to see a lot of evolution in the character. We're going to see evolution in the way the character thinks. This is not going to prevent us from seeing a Puritan writing at its best, serving its didactic purpose. Every Puritan writing was supposed to represent was a writing that was ultimately useful for the rest of the community, and it had to serve as a lesson to be learned by the rest of the community of the Puritan community. So that didactic purpose and that plain style with which it is written, lacking any unnecessary decor, are two of the staples of Puritan writings. So as I said, this plain style and this didactic purpose of the narrative makes it much more reliable than other works in prose that we had seen to the moment. In the first place, we find it more reliable than John Smith's story, because Mary Rowlandson does not seem to have any intention of overdoing her merits or overstating anything in favor of making herself, her family, or even her community look any better than they should. She was critical when she had to be critical. She normally finds reasons to all types of tragedy that happen around us, and she doesn't find the reasons in the Native Americans. These Native Americans served as a devilish tool. So the Native Americans are immediately stripped of any type of humanity. They're turned into mere tools of the devil to do the devil's wishes and the devil's mischief. This is a punishment for something that the Puritans have done, that the community has done. So she can only endure it and try to come back to be able to survive that narrative and be able to tell it to different generations so they can learn about it and serve that didactic purpose. Mary Rowlandson's stakes at this captivity were extremely high, because not only does she lose an infant at the beginning of the kidnapping, she has two children kidnapped that are later released in exchange of a ransom. So this shows how Mary Rowlandson, in after several removes, acquires experience in understanding the community where she is held hostage, and that is going to produce in Mary Rowlandson a shift in her, if not in her heart, at least in her spirit, and a higher level of acceptance towards the type of reality and the type of people that the Native Americans were at that time. So the same way that we say that in general, these narratives and stories about Native Americans in early times, and we're going to see a fictional case at the end of this class, have a dehumanizing effect. Mary Rowlandson's account is going to have a sort of the rehumanizing warmth in it as she comes to an understanding of the Native Americans, and you can see how the signs of kindness increase as the narrative advances. And she is able to see that improvement and that change in her heart, and to distinguish very clearly her raw, tormented feelings at the beginning of the narrative and her more peaceful, balanced feelings that she has at the end of these removes and at the end of this kidnapping. Mary Rowlandson traveled from England to America, and that is going to be one of the distinguishing factors of these four first authors regarding the following. All the rest of the authors are going to be authors that are going to live in America and develop their work in America. In the case, not live in America. They're going to be born in America, and they're going to develop their work in America. In the case of Jonathan Edwards is the first Puritan that we hear about in this course of the other three previous authors that are Puritan that is born in America. His is a job that is almost impossible, as he has to work on the Great Awakening. The Great Awakening is a call to rekindle spirits and make them more aware of the tremendous crisis that the Puritans as a people are suffering, and to try to relaunch or recapture the interest of the churchgoers with the Puritan principles, and to maintain this covenant of God. Sorry, this covenant with God, this agreement with God. You're going to have to interrupt me for a sec. Sorry, you're going to have to let me interrupt my speech for a second. I have to go drink water. Okay, I'll be back. I'm going to fill my bottle. Back in a moment, okay? Give me a moment. Sorry about that. Sometimes the world of Puritan American writers is confused because there are many who come from this religious movement. I guess that is a general statement about all the Puritan writers, or about the current Puritan community in America. Puritanism. This is the, let's say, this is an attempt to start a second Big Bang in Puritanism, but it's just a way of preventing and delaying an obvious decline of Puritanism. Religious revival than spiritual revival. Well, I would say that maybe religious revival would be more accurate in terms of it talks about a religion, and spiritual could also refer to an attitude towards life. Basically, what the Puritans and in particular the preachers were aware of is that people were not extremely impressed with the dramatic sermons that they were receiving, Jonathan Edwards is famous, and his fame relies on his sermons, and basically on one sermon in particular, the one we study in this unit, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." So, the Great Awakening is an attempt to rekindle the talked about covenant that we've been mentioning so frequently in this class, and it was a failed attempt, and it just managed to lengthen the decline. So the decline in Puritanism is going to be significant and steady from the beginning of the 18th century. And as a matter of fact, as pure leaders, we're not going to see any more religious leaders in the rest of our course. And as you can see, the beginning of the course is so influenced by religion as a driving factor of society. Other elements are going to start to happen at the same time. This is a bustling 18th century, and at the same time that we have the Great Awakening, we have the Age of Enlightenment happening at the same time. So the enlightenment of science and knowledge can be seen initially as something that enters in conflict or in contrast with religious awakening or with religious and spiritual revival, as Paola was saying. But in the case of Jonathan Edwards, funnily enough, he embraces awakening and he also embraces science and knowledge. So he has a different view. This is absolutely renovating. And renovating, and it's an attempt to reform the way that Puritan religion is expressed. Was this met with gratitude by the rest of the Puritans? No, it was met with an extreme amount of criticism, and many accused Jonathan Edwards of being heretic, of heresy. Because his sermons were a departure from the plain style that was so Puritan, and it substituted the plain style with a very direct address that wanted to instill fear in the people that heard the sermon, and it was geared as a fancy vehicle to create a sense of panic in the audience. This is normally attempted through, based on a reliance on similes and metaphors. When we talk about the sinners in the hands of an angry God, even the title is shocking. What we have is a very strong literary piece that has sometimes it has the feeling of being a treatise. Sometimes it has the feeling of being a poem of anger, a poem that is trying to convey images of hell and images of the consequences of being a sinner, and is giving basically the Puritans a wake-up call of saying, this is your last chance. Get on board or get ready to go to hell. And you could go to hell as soon as right now, if that is the wish of God. So that immediacy, that urgency, is something that is very powerful in these poems. In these sermons. Urgency. And so Edwards did not use plain style. Didactic? Well, it was didactic. You know, there's a saying in Spanish, la letra con sangre entra. What is more religious is 10th or 12th century monastic experience more religious than the Inquisition in Spain? I think that you get the idea that it's a different style. If the style before was we have to be good Puritans because we know that not everybody is going to be saved. That was the old version. We have to reinstate the covenant with God because no one else is going to do it. We're the only chosen people that have been brought to the chosen land to do the work of God and to deserve salvation. Versus Jonathan Edwards' style, enter Jonathan Edwards, and the word would say, repent because you're about to burn in hell. All of you, you sinners, you know who you are. Looking at the people in the audience, prying their eyes and trying to make them feel uncomfortable and feeling scared inside the church. Is that didactic? It could be if it manages to make people feel more religious and act more religiously. But plain, this is not plain at all. No, let me read just a couple of lines from Jonathan Edwards' work. I would say that it falls in very long from being plain. What it talks about people that are in sin, it says in the beginning in number 1 in line 10 on page 83, that they were always exposed to destruction as one that stands or walks in slippery places is always exposed to fall. This is implied in the manner of their destruction coming upon them being represented by their foot sliding. The same is expressed, Psalm 73:18. Surely thou didst them in slippery places, thou casted them down into destruction. So for the Puritans to not accept exactly, symbols and metaphors are signs of not being plain style. That's why it was so difficult for Anne Bradstreet to make people understand that her poetry was not intended for the audience to read. It was her attempt at expressing her doubts, but always returning to the covenant. Whereas Jonathan Edwards is using symbols and using metaphors to instill fear, and he doesn't care what other preachers believe. He doesn't care what previous generations of Puritans are thinking about him. He is expelled from a congregation for his radicalness. And if we say that Puritan religion is a fundamentalist religion because it didn't aspire to the global salvation, it aspired to the salvation of a few of their own followers, the work of Jonathan Edwards is a radical attempt at saving a fundamentalist church. So you can only understand that if you add radical to fundamental, you're probably going very, very far to the extreme. So he was an extremist in his manner and in his acts. Another question, could I say that he used anaphora due to the repetition of the word wrath? Yes, there's both anaphora and an alliteration. Alliteration is when you repeat a sound. And let me just show you places where he repeats sounds, because it's very significant. I think I have a couple of places where I noted down alliterative ideas. I don't have it. Too bad. I probably have it somewhere else. But anaphora, you can say for sure. Everything that you find that makes sense within a poetic structure, and taking into consideration that he's using poetic structures inside the framework of a sermon, which is rather unusual. So he follows the standard structure of a Puritan sermon. But at the same time, he overdoes it by the type of language that he produces. There is an anaphoric use of, for example, a God, lines 34 to 36. It's used three times. There is nothing that keeps wicked men at one moment out of hell but the mere pleasure of God. By the mere pleasure of God, I mean his sovereign pleasure, his arbitrary will, restrained by no obligation, hindered by no manner of difficulty, any more than if nothing else but God's mere will had in the last degree or in any respect whatsoever any hand in the preservation of wicked men one moment. Twice repeated pleasure. Three times repeated God, twice repeated will. So as you can see, there is a stacking of an idea that is repeated and pounded time and time again as a way of driving the message home. Going on to the next author, we have Benjamin Franklin. In the case of Benjamin Franklin, what we have is the yang. This is a period of yin and yang. Jonathan Edwards was to religion and religious awakening, Benjamin Franklin was to the enlightenment of the people, and this is the era of the people. American independence sparks many patterns of popular empowerment. So there's going to be an empowerment of regular people. And this empowerment of regular people actually means that anybody can achieve what they want if they put in enough effort in life. The concept of the self-made man. And this ties into, if you sprinkle a bit of religion on it, to the American dream. So the American dream is the self-made man that is independent. And the first step to be independent is to be an independent country. And Benjamin Franklin represents and is the epitome of the late or the second half of the 18th century American spirit, or we can say New World spirit. Benjamin Franklin is a signee of the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the peace treaty in France. He is one of the founding fathers. He is a polymath that had so many roles in life that it is very difficult to list them all. I think that I produced in the slides just to help you understand the dimension of Benjamin Franklin's breath in the time. He was an American version of Isaac Newton, to put it in a certain way. But I would say that even more diverse in terms of areas of life that he successfully conquered. He is known to be a successful author, printer, thinker, political theorist, a politician, Freemason, postmaster, scientist, inventor, civic activist, statesman, diplomat. He's one of the most influential members of the 18th century. His life represents the 18th century, in fact, and how this very, very English area of the eastern coast of America turns into an area that seeks political and cultural independence. Some of the contributions of Benjamin Franklin to the world are the design of the first library, setting up the first newspapers in America, the invention of the lightning rod, the invention of the Franklin stove, very interesting studies in electricity. That led to understanding how to harness the power of electricity for the use of man. The study of the waves that traverse the Atlantic and how to travel efficiently across the Atlantic. Benjamin Franklin's studies are so precise that the routes that he suggested as the best ways of traveling by boat from Europe to America and from America to Europe are still used nowadays. And he made those calculations while aboard the ships that took him back and forth, measuring the temperatures of the waters as he passed by them. He was an accomplished publisher. And a part of this concept of the self-made man is installed in his autobiography, and how it contains some of the most popular aphorisms to humanity. So he believed very much in the idea of constant self-improvement and constant self-evaluation. All of these ideas as part of this concept of the self-made man. So the shift that we see from everything before Benjamin Franklin to everything after Benjamin Franklin is the cultural independence of America. That is very slow at first and acquires speed as we advance. Independence of America. Independence. Too many word letters there. Independence. Yeah, there you go. The concept of the first creating a sentiment of belonging to a different people that were no longer subjects of a king, but designers of their own destiny. This idea of empowering the people, empowering the citizen, something that was so radically different to everything that happened so far. And this is not based on religious necessity to reach salvation, but on a novel concept of goodwill. Goodwill as the driving force behind Benjamin Franklin's suggestions to the world through his autobiography or his almanac. He shows us some of the mechanisms that authors are going to use not so far in the future. And one of those mechanisms is a frame narrator or the use of a pseudonym, using pseudonyms and using frame narrators as a way of comfortably conveying controversial ideas or ideas that are challenging through a different voice to one's own, or creating alternative personas to oneself. The next two units have to do with slavery. In the first case, we're going to study self-evaluation is part of Puritan mentality, but in a moral pragmatic way. Self-evaluation would be a way of not incurring in sin, and something that would be taken as always. To do your best is to do the bare minimum, and it's put in a negative context in Puritan chain of thought. Whereas self-evaluation is a way of aspiring to perfection. So Benjamin Franklin and Enlightenment and the period of optimism that followed the American independence make self-evaluation a positive aspect. It is striving for perfection, whereas from the religious point of view, it was striving to avoid going to hell. So the reward could not be more different. Benjamin Franklin believed in personal wealth and personally becoming richer. And he said, if you follow this, you're going to be successful in life. Okay, so it's not only about being a good person. It's about being successful, and it's also about being wealthy. Whereas in religion, everything that you did was because you were afraid of God and because you did not want to go to hell. So your maximum aspiration was to be saved from going to hell and reaching and reaching heaven. But it seemed the reward was more not burning in hell rather than going to heaven. It's stated in a negative point of view. This is earthly. I don't understand exactly that statement, Paula. Going back to Olauda, not related. Yeah, I know. It's not related to heaven. What I'm saying is that the Puritans put everything in a negative perspective, and this practical materialism that Benjamin Franklin follows puts everything in a positive perspective. So one is extremely negative; it's to avoid burning in hell, and the other one is extremely positive; it's to achieve success and wealth in life. I always say this wrong. I think it's Olaudé, not Olauda. Olaudé Equiano. Slave narrative, purely American genre again. Why? Because American was tolerant with slavery and was so for the first century of its history until the American Civil War changed the rules of slavery forever. Did it do it in a perfect way? No, by no means. Were there tremendous consequences, unimaginable consequences that we are only starting to see to their full extent even nowadays? The choice of America to secure slavery in its constitution is a foundational error that still has consequences in current American social reality. Of course, the effects of the American Civil War, the effects of the chain migration, sorry, the chain the mass migrations that followed the American Civil War, and the tremendous social differentiations that the migration and the sudden end of slavery had in America are still felt nowadays. To understand all of that, to understand everything that you'll probably study when you study contemporary American literature, when you continue to study Mundos Anglófonos, you have to understand the beginning, and the beginning is that the slave narratives were a very powerful tool for abolitionists. They were based on the idea that abolition could be achieved through creating a social pressure and a social majority. As we know, that took a very long time to be carried out, and slave narratives are based on breaking two slaver rules that are very useful for dehumanizing the slaves as people. The first purpose of slave narratives is to denounce dehumanization of the black people. By dehumanizing the slaves, it was easier to spin a narrative of supremacism and to perpetuate a situation that was contradictory to the principles on which the early American Republic was created, the the concepts of liberty, equality, and freedom. This concept of dehumanization was fought through slave narratives through two fundamental aspects. The two pillars of fighting slave narratives was based on conquering literacy and conquering religious belonging. And why was this so important for slaves to become literate and to embrace religion? First of all, literacy is fundamental as a way of expressing themselves and being able to tell their story and to write about their story, and also to demonstrate that they are not intellectually inferior to whites, to Europeans, to the dominant class. Religious belonging had a sense of had for the slaves a sense of betrayal, because they were renouncing to the original religion that they might have brought. In many cases, in these cases, in both the case of Volada Equiano and in the case of Phyllis Wheatley, we're going to see slaves that were brought from Africa. So they were first generation slaves, not slaves born in America, first generation slaves. And these first generation slaves are going to have something in common. They're going to abandon their ideas that have to do with religion, and they're going to embrace Christian religion. It can be pagan, or it can be other types of gods, other ways of worshiping, other African religions. There was an embracing of Christian religion, because it was the way of proving that they were also worthy of salvation. And if they were able to be religious, they were able of salvation. And therefore, it was even more inhumane to have them in captivity. So slave narratives follow a fixed framework of narrating the life of a slave, where he is he or she is kidnapped from a remote territory. The inhumanity and the cruelty of the process is highlighted in that period. He arrives they arrive to America, and they have to go through the ordeal of obtaining their liberty, normally through violent means, by escaping, by entering in a fight against their masters or slaveholders, and by reaching that salvation that normally meant traveling to the states of the North that did not vouch for slavery, even the territory of Canada that was where slavery was not allowed. These type of situations made them normally reach their freedom either through escape or by buying their freedom. In the case of buying their freedom, they would be met with a harsh reality that Equiano met during his lifetime. He perceived racism as strongly when he was a slave in the South, that when he was a free man in the North. When he was a free man in the North, he still perceived the same underlying racism, even though it did not lead to persecution of him as a slave. So we have to separate slavery as an institution that changed humans, and slavery as a concept, or let's say this this sense of supremacism that was that was pervasive both in the slave states and in the non-slave states. In the non-slave states, the mainstream chain of thought was that slavery was not allowed, but that whites had their place and blacks had theirs. And in the same way, it is an extension of the supremacism that the European or the white people in America already had towards the Native Americans. In the next unit, Unit 8, what we have is Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley has kept you busy these days where you were writing your PEC. I have to say that it's probably one of the most disappointing correction periods that I've had, because I've seen very few instances where the messages that I tried to portray in Phyllis Wheatley's class were fully understood by all of you, and you had a very strong understanding of what is key to understand in Phyllis Wheatley. In Phyllis Wheatley, you basically have to understand that her poetry is very sophisticated. And the sophistication comes from several elements of her poetry. It has a neoclassical touch in general. It has several layers of meaning. And this is the first thing that flew over the head of the majority of the people that answered the PEC. Several layers of meaning. In the most visible reading, or a superficial reading, would make you come to believe that Phyllis Wheatley accepts her status, and even understands or justifies several times the institution of slavery. And here is where we have to put in play the second part. There's always in her poetry a subversive hidden message. And this subversive hidden message is absolutely abolitionist. It is a reprimand of slave practices. And there is a stark contrast between the use of the choice of words that she uses to refer to black people as a race, as a people, and the words that she uses for the intended audience, the white people of America. The white people of America might believe when listening to a poem that the poem is about, for example, the scholars of Cambridge and how well they are being prepared for the future that awaits them. But at the same time, the message is telling them, don't make the same mistake of your ancestors. Suppress the serpent in its egg. Don't wait for the egg to hatch. Don't form an allegiance with this ongoing sin. Save yourself and save us. So there is always a message of, if you want to reach salvation, you have to start by seeing the injustices of the world, and the biggest injustice in the world is slavery, and you have to rectify that situation. So what was disappointing about correcting so many works is that everything stayed in the obvious, in this most visible reading of the verses, and very few of your answers went beyond and talked about the subversive hidden message that in those verses in particular are pretty obvious. In one of them, it's talking about suppressing a serpent in its egg. It's prevent the sin from happening. Not any sin, not all the sins in the world. Of course, all the sins in the world, but the sin that your parents and your grandparents are responsible for, the ones that they created a situation that has probably sent them to hell, don't go to hell. Be the first of your kind to reach salvation. And in the other one, the human race divine, in the same poem it talks about the salvation and joining the angelic train, it seems obvious that there is a cynical use of a human race divine. If all of the men are equal in the eyes of God, how can there be some of the men that are more divine than others? How can there be an entire race that is more divine than others? And that contradictory way of using a vocabulary for her own agenda and against the people that believe in a different way, this is the wittiest way of using literature. Using literature against your enemies, using literature in favor of pushing your ideas. I'm two-thirds through, and I've got four authors to go, and I've surpassed the time of the class 8 minutes. I'm going to quickly gloss over the four last authors that I'm sure that you have a solid idea about them. In the first one, we have Washington Irving. I didn't remember if Washington Irving came before Fenimore Cooper. Washington Irving has to be remembered and celebrated for being the father of the short story. And even though his reputation has not remained as strong as the people that he inspired in a later generation, he is responsible for creating this truly American form of narrative, the truly American form. So this genre, the genre of the short story, is going to be the first sign of distinct American cultural independence from Great Britain. It's not a matter anymore of repeating structures, repeating ideas, repeating topics. It's going to be an age of discovering new stories, discovering new realities. To get there, however, there is a heavy reliance on German folklore. And if it's not imitating Great Britain for a great deal of time, it's because it's too busy imitating other literatures to find its own voice. In this attempt to find its own voice, Washington Irving becomes the first great celebrity of the first great American literary celebrity. From this point of view, the status that Washington Irving holds nowadays is only rests on the legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle. Those two stories are the only two stories that remain from the entire body of work of Washington Irving that make him be part of the most significant writers in the American canon. Is that entirely fair? Well, one of the problems that Washington Irving had with his own readership was that the majority of his career was spent paying attention to in the majority of the time to foreign sources and foreign stories. In the case of Rip Van Winkle and Sleepy Hollow, they are German folklore imported and adapted to American settings, not that they're originally American. In the case of the what makes Washington Irving a celebrity in Spain, for example, or very relevant figure in Spanish literature or in Spanish history, is because the tales of Alhambra, or the Alhambra, as it was initially published, is a very significant work of fiction about Andalusian reality, and it is a combination of sketches or descriptions of places in Granada, along with some short stories were a testing ground to create stories with an American form. So the Alhambra can be celebrated as Washington Irving's contribution to the legend of medieval Spain and the origins of significant places like the Alhambra. Regarding other elements, and I'm probably going too fast here, faster than I would wish. We have James Fenimore Cooper, he is responsible for giving Americans American stories. He reinterprets captivity narratives, for example, from a fictional point of view, and he creates paradigmatic figures of the good Indian and the bad Indian. These representations are very harmful for the Native American people, because basically it dehumanizes them partially, and it puts them in terms of a supremacist white person that can rely on some Indians being barbaric but good-willed, and other Native Americans being barbaric and evil and cruel. So both of these cliches are served as ways of dehumanizing Native Americans in the eyes of the American readership, and I would say the international readership, because this is where the frontier literature starts to really pick up speed, and it becomes extremely relevant to talk about stories that take place in America, and they become interesting not only for the American audience, but for an international audience. In the case of Fenimore Cooper, he's celebrated for being able to create this American story, this American fiction. He was not very sure if he could achieve this, but finally he becomes renowned for sea narratives, the same thing that we're going to talk about in the second semester regarding Herman Melville, and Native American stories. Things that I have to talk about James Fenimore Cooper is his radical view on miscegenation, or the interracial relationships, interracial marriages, something that was deemed barbaric at the time, and that he is completely against, or at least reading his works, we can understand that he positions himself against miscegenation and the possibility of marriage between the white community and the Native American community, or the white community and the black community. There was a sense that that was not natural, and that should never be allowed in this time. And he contributed to increasing that sense by giving bad story endings to people that engage in miscegenation, and giving happy endings to people that refrained from this practice. In Unit 11, we study Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson is a figure that can be considered as much of a philosopher as a poet, as much of a philosopher as an essayist, as much of a philosopher as a writer. His current popularity rests on the essay Nature, and it is the foundational work for transcendentalism. Transcendentalism is a school of thought where very much in the line of the lack of religious interest that we saw in Benjamin Franklin, there is a search for inner spirituality. And to be in harmony with nature. So this contrasts openly with the Manifest Destiny, because it gives a different message of preserving nature rather than destroying nature for the purpose of expansion, for the purpose of improvement. Emerson is a key cultural figure of the 19th century, and he is a source of inspiration of other transcendentalists like Henry David Thoreau, of romantics such as Nathaniel Hawthorne or Herman Melville. He is a very clear figure of opposition for a figure such as Edgar Allan Poe. A huge inspiration for the biggest and most different poets of the 19th century, Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson. And Emerson is going to be part of our conversation in the second semester, as you can see, because from Emerson, everything seems to emerge from the light of Emerson. He is the cultural. He's a cultural lighthouse of the time. Everything seems to revolve around Emerson. There is a shift of importance, and the place where Emerson decides to live, Concord, Massachusetts, becomes a cultural capital of America for a brief but very intense period of time, where this romanticism that begins with Washington Irving continues to grow. Transcendentalists are considered part of the Romantic movement, and Emerson's ideas of inner spirituality, harmony with nature, had sometimes tints of Hinduism, and there is an inheritance from Puritanism, which is that works have to have a didactic purpose. Okay, so all of these ideas, if Emerson is the person to enact the theory of transcendentalist, Thoreau is the true transcendentalist, and he lives as a transcendentalist, and proves the things that Emerson talks about in nature, and goes to live alone on a pond, trying to be self-sufficient, and the result of his work is Walden, after spending 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days separated or segregated from society, to be in real contact with nature and come back to talk about it and to write about his ideas. His ideas are against property and against landowners, and he is the father of civil disobedience. He never received recognition during his lifetime. So, even though I've left so many details outside of this talk that I could talk for another hour and a half perfectly well, I think that I've covered many interesting factors that can help you focus better what you need to study for this exam, and for hopefully perform well in the upcoming exam. I would like to thank you for your sustained attention throughout the semester, attending classes in person or online, and wish you best of luck for the exam whenever you decide to take it, next week or in 3 weeks' time. Okay, so thank you very much. Let me know how the exam goes. Let me know what challenges you find. I'll love to receive emails by you telling me about your experience, and best luck. Thank you very much.